Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. 1 week after a devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Nepal, officials say thousands of people are still missing, including about 1,000 Europeans. Officials said Saturday the death toll has passed 6,600, with most of those killed in and around the capital, Kathmandu. Authorities say there is little hope more survivors will be found in the massive rubble. Survivors are urging the government and aid groups to move faster to get food, water, and other assistance to the many people living in the open after losing their homes. In Kathmandu, some signs of normalcy have returned as merchants conducted business and some residents packed up tents and moved indoors. Nigeria's military says it has rescued 234 women and children kidnapped by Boko Haram in the country's northeast. A military official said the latest rescue took place Thursday in Sambisa Forest. A statement says this set is in addition to the previous individuals earlier rescued during the ongoing operation in the area. The military went on to say the assault on the forest is continuing from various fronts and efforts are concentrated on rescuing hostages and destroying all terrorist camps and facilities in the forest. Earlier in the week, a similar-sized group was also rescued from the same forest. Several hundred girls and women are now reported to have been returned to safety in the past week. It was not immediately clear whether any of the rescued females included students who were kidnapped from a boarding school in Chibok a year ago. This is VOA News. John Kerry made the first visit to Sri Lanka by a U.S. Secretary of State in a decade on Saturday, championing the new government's fresh effort at democratic reform and promising to deepen ties with a country that sits at a strategic crossroads in the vast Indian Ocean. The top American diplomat arrived early Saturday, local time, in Colombo and met with Sri Lanka's president and foreign minister.
Today we talked about the enormous progress that Sri Lanka has made in just a few short months, and progress that can be measured, progress on restoring democratic institutions, progress on creating more accountable governance.
Sri Lanka's government, determined to end years of international isolation linked to its long war with Tamil separatists, rolled out the red carpet for Kerry literally. He entered the foreign ministry under a welcome sign bearing his image and was greeted by musicians playing horns and drums and dancers in silver breastplates as he proceeded down a long crimson rug. The chief prosecutor for the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore has announced criminal charges against six police officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray, saying the state medical examiner has determined his death in police custody was a homicide. State's attorney Marilyn Mosby said Friday that Gray suffered a severe and critical neck injury while being transported in the police van on April 12th. U.S. health officials say Ebola survivors can spread the disease through unprotected sex many months after being declared free of the virus. In a report issued Friday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention detailed the case of a 44-year-old Liberian woman who is believed to have contracted Ebola through sexual intercourse with an Ebola survivor. Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge, has given birth to her second child, a girl. Kensington Palace said in a brief statement that the Duchess was safely delivered of a daughter at 8:34 a.m. London time, less than 3 hours after she was admitted to a hospital. The birth was announced by a crier.
Oh, yay! Oh, yay! On this day, the 2nd of May, in the year 2015, we welcome with humble duty the second born of their Royal Highnesses, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge.
The baby weighs 8 pounds 3 ounces. The palace added that Kate and her child are both doing well and that Prince William was present for the birth. The princess is fourth in line to the throne and the fifth great-grandchild of Queen Elizabeth II. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
They have realized, and just like the overwhelming majority of Nigerian society, that the fight against terrorism is a collective responsibility.
Nigerian army rescues Boko Haram hostages from the Sambisa forest.
Ugandans have been waiting for the tabling of key constitutional reforms to parliament by government as agreed upon between the various political parties.
Ugandan opposition and civil society groups embark on a nationwide campaign to demand electoral reforms ahead of next year's election.
Literally, just about everything in UCOM and just about everything in AFRICOM can be shared left and right if we have to do that.
And the U.S.-Africa Command aims to help bring peace and stability to the continent. We'll have details, those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A spokesman for the Nigerian army says increased cooperation from citizens is significantly contributing to the rescue of women and children in the Sambisa forest. Colonel Sani Kukashika Usman also called on the Boko Haram militants to surrender, adding that the army will not relent in the effort to ensure the extremists don't have any haven in the Sambisa forest as well as other parts of the country. His comments came after the army announced it has rescued 234 more women and girls from the Sambisa forest. Colonel Usman told me earlier the military would want the Boko Haram militant to surrender and go through the country's legal process.
Yes, on Thursday, we were able to rescue another set of 234 women and children from Kaori and Konduga axis of the Sambisa forest.
Should we be expecting more rescues as you comb the rest of the Sambisa forest, which I understand is a very vast area?
Quite right. You should expect more. And what we are even trying to do is to inform the terrorists, if at all they are taking advantage of this medium, to surrender, because our intention is not to kill everyone inside. We rather have them arrested and prosecuted. But definitely we have been working so hard collectively to ensure that no terrorist camp will ever exist in Sambisa forest in particular and Nigeria in general.
How are the rest of your allied forces, neighboring allied forces, talking about Cameroon, Chad and Niger, cooperating with the Nigerian military in this Sambisa forest operation?
Yeah, they have been cooperating fully well, and it has been very wonderful and marvelous in the sense that they have realized, and just like the overwhelming majority of Nigerian society, that the fight against terrorism, it's a collective responsibility.
Well, there are suggestions that these terrorists, once they see that these military officials or soldiers are coming, they use other means to escape. Are there any moves to ensure they don't escape and possibly arrested and prosecuted, as you initially said?
Yeah, there are. You see, there are so many approaches to fighting insurgency, and we are not taking any chances. And you remember why the insurgency or terrorism activity lasted this long is simply because they easily melt with the Nigerian society. But now people are becoming wiser and becoming more informed, and they realize the dangers of having terrorists in their midst. So they always expose them. So we get timely and accurate information, and we act promptly. So if such escape will may not be likely.
So there's a renewed cooperation from the citizenry as we speak. Is that the case? Has that contributed to the successes that the military has been chalking so far?
Tremendously, and we are still soliciting for more of it.
Colonel Sani Kukashika Usman is a spokesman for the Nigerian military. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Burundi protest organizers have called for a two-day halt to demonstrations against President Pierre Nkurunziza's move to seek a third term. There have been six straight days of protest in the capital, Bujumbura, in which civil rights groups say at least six people have been killed and dozens injured. Jean-Claude Nkundwa is a peace activist in the capital, Bujumbura. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him by phone to find out the latest.
Military are still there, it's relatively calm. People are taking breaths, and everything seems normal in the capital city. Some places, like in Musaga, for example, you'll find some people blocked the route because they are afraid that the police can get in and selectively pick up some people and bring them in the jail. You can find soldiers all around in the capital city, and there you can see that life is normal. Everyone is going back to business, and things are normal.
There have been reports of the use of live ammunition at protests and the torture of those protesters who are detained. What do you know about that?
It has been very difficult to know what is happening about the people who have been detained. What we're hearing today is that the family members of those people are having difficulties over having access to where they are. The police seem to be really hiding them, and some people are very, really concerned that they are being tortured. I don't think many people know what's happening. So civil society organization leaders and some other political opposition leaders, together with the members of the family of those people, have been going to plead and be able to see them, but it has been very difficult. So there is no open information that we know so far about the detained people, who are like now 600.
See, so this two-day halt in the protests, do the organizers intend to come back on Monday? Have they said that?
Yes, the coordination committee announcement say that they have taken these 2 days break first because they want to have time to participate in the funeral of the people who died during this protest. And the second objective is to give time for Pierre Nkurunziza to think about his decision. And third, to be able to engage more nonviolent strategies that they can use on Monday if Pierre Nkurunziza doesn't change his position in this weekend.
The government has insisted that the protesters stay off the streets, and despite mounting international pressure on President Pierre Nkurunziza, do you see a compromise being worked out, or do you think the protests will proceed?
The information we're having here from the international community is not encouraging. For example, when we think about the Russian position that the news is giving, that they're asking the UN just to be out of Burundi political conflict. So this is not encouraging, because if the international community doesn't really do something, we are afraid that most of the solutions that are going to come are not going to be constructive. So it's not encouraging, and I expect to see, to hear what will be the alternative after this block of China and Russia.
Jean-Claude Nkundwa is a Burundian peace activist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Bujumbura. Meanwhile, the Burundian government has vowed a major crackdown on political protests after accusing opposition and civil society groups of providing cover for a terrorist enterprise. Jeremy Nkendekumana is a Burundian member of the East African Legislative Assembly, or EALA, and a former chairman of President Nkurunziza's ruling CNDD-FDD party in Burundi. He joins us live via telephone link up from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Good evening, Jeremy.
Good evening.
Yes, Jeremy, let me ask you this question. Former rebel leader and main opposition leader Agathon Rwasa says his party and other groups will not allow President Nkurunziza to violate the constitution. Do you think his statement is justified?
First of all, I'd like to say that for 10 years, Burundians are now enjoying peace. Just after the assassination of the president, Nkurunziza in that year. So, we think that the peace in Burundi now is in full implementation. or Arusha Peace Accord, and also in the Constitution of Burundi. So those two legal instruments provide that the President of Burundi can be elected for a term of 5 years, renewable once. Now in Burundi we have a debate as to whether the President can be elected for a term or not. Now this debate has no room since the two legal instruments are clear on this issue, saying that no one can run for more than 2 terms.
But his supporters argue that he is not running for a third term because Burundians did not vote for him on 2 consecutive occasions. So does he have a case at this point? Because his supporters are vouching for him and state institutions appear to be on his side. He enjoys a majority support as well from the countryside.
I'd like to say that.
Hello? We lost Mr. Ingendu Kukumana. We will try to get him back and we will come back. We'll take a moment break and we'll be right with you. Opposition and civil society groups in Uganda have launched a Citizens for Reforms Now campaign to pressure Parliament to institute electoral reforms ahead of next year's general election. Parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga, a leading opposition member, says opponents of President Yoweri Museveni have dismissed electoral reform proposals presented to Parliament by the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. Among the proposals is a call to change the name of the Electoral Commission. Mpuuga told me the government's proposals are cosmetic.
Members and the society groups belonging to A4C, if you remember A4C and 4GC, have again come together to launch a citizens' campaign. Codename Citizens Reforms Now. You can call it silent, to try and put pressure on the regime and the members of parliament to make sure that they consider the kind of reforms that were submitted to parliament by political party groups and IPOL and the civil society groups. Remember, Ugandans have been waiting for the tabling of key constitutional reforms to parliament by government as agreed upon between the various political parties under the inter-party organization dialogue called IPOD, which, of course, the ruling party is a member. And these were to be merged with other electoral reforms.
Specifically, what reforms is your group seeking?
To be precise, we had made a plethora of proposals, but I can summarize them in about 5 or 7 key demands we had made and proposals. One, we want a restructuring of the Electoral Commission by changing its appointment process, composition, and strengthening its independence. This, of course, includes the appointment of other electoral officials, like returning officers and presiding officials. What we got from the amendment bill by the regime was changing its name. And by changing its name, they think they have changed the Electoral Commission. That is ridiculous. Two, we wanted an amendment to the electoral laws pertaining to the voting, tallying, and transmission of election results from the polling stations to the National Tally Center. We know it has been problematic throughout the election we held over the last couple of years. Three, we had wanted a restreaming of the role of the force, such as the army and the police, during the election. Then four, we want to see a strengthening and independence of other statutory bodies like the commission, reviewing their appointment and execution of their duties, especially during polls time. And of course, protecting public funds from abuse during elections by the government. We know Mr. Museveni over the last election spent about $2 trillion to procure the last election. Everybody knows it and where it landed the country and the economy in general. So we wanted also to make sure that there is a review of the role of the media during elections to ensure that there is equal access to media houses by all political players and enhance media impartiality. If you followed the last couple of elections, the media houses where opposition leaders were blocked from access, even where they needed to pay for a talk show, they paid, and eventually on the last hour, they were denied entry by government functionaries intimidating media owners. Those and more other proposals that were made by political parties in agreement with the ruling party, I think Mr. Museveni finally simply sat somewhere with a few of his friends, rejected without even blinking an eyelid these proposals, and they simply came with a few laughable proposals to Parliament.
The Electoral Commission says for the first time they will be using the biometric system of registration as part of the effort to clean up the electoral system to ensure transparency in the next general election. Don't you think that it's an effort worth commending?
Now, one of the issues we had wanted changed, for starters, is the manner in which the voter register is constituted to make sure that its integrity is enhanced. As you are aware, the kind of biometric data the Electoral Commission is talking about is not its job. It's somebody else's job. In fact, without having to reflect on mandate under the law that puts back the Commission, they are not doing this job. They are simply picking data from other people, which data cannot be relied upon because those collecting it are not the one who's mandated to collect data for the purposes of an election, which is why in Parliament yesterday, even sections of the ruling party members in Parliament rejected this and wanted the Commission to independently come up with a register, because this register was the handiwork of a few regime honchos and it cannot be relied upon as independent data.
Matthias Mpuuga is a Ugandan opposition parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Africa Command is the newest geographic command in the U.S. military structure, and despite the vast size of the African continent, it is also the smallest military command. It has only one base in Africa, and it's headquartered in Germany. Still, the command carries out hundreds of operations per year aimed at making Africa a more stable place to live. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more on the history and the future of this command.
Africa Command, or AFRICOM for short, was created less than a decade ago to better focus U.S. military engagement on the African continent. Before 2007, U.S. military activities in Africa were conducted by European Command, Central Command, which covers the Middle East, and even Pacific Command. AFRICOM's sole base in the tiny African nation of Djibouti was previously used by U.S. Central Command due to its close proximity to Yemen. AFRICOM spokesman Pat Barnes says despite the need to travel great distances, the military intentionally chose not to create a new base in Africa.
When AFRICOM was stood up, one of the key components of it standing up was that we would have something called a very small footprint. Given the history and colonialism and things, you maybe wouldn't want to have a large standing presence on the continent.
Barnes says AFRICOM's major focus is building defense capabilities. It carries out hundreds of exercises for African governments each year, teaching everything from how to load a C-130 aircraft to how soldiers operate under civilian authority.
It may not get as much attention, but it really is the bellwether for what we do in terms of engagements.
What does get the most attention, of course, is AFRICOM's military operations. The African continent is plagued by extremist threats, including Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Boko Haram in Nigeria, and Al-Qaeda-linked groups in northern Mali. But Barnes says AFRICOM only has 3 people in Somalia and less than a dozen in Nigeria to support intelligence sharing and logistics. Critics say a nation as powerful as the United States should do more to help. But for AFRICOM, it's not that simple.
We will only send people where they are requested. So it's not like we can go and make our own requests.
Dan Hampton, a professor of security at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says the Boko Haram issue was further complicated in Nigeria by the recently concluded presidential election and the negative perceptions of using foreign support to fight an internal problem.
I think there's going to be an opportunity now with the elections over. I mean, at least I hope that you're going to see more and better cooperation between Nigeria and the U.S. on tackling this problem in the near future.
To help ease the burden of such a small force, AFRICOM and the U.S. European Command recently developed a plan to quickly share forces without first going through a lot of bureaucratic red tape. General Philip Breedlove, head of European Command, says it is a model for the future of the U.S. military.
Literally, just about everything in EUCOM and just about everything in AFRICOM can be shared left and right if we have to do that.
But with Russia's increased aggression and a nearly 300% jump in U.S. military activities on the African continent in the last 8 years, the force size and structure could become an issue.
I think it is fair to say that we probably ought to look at that force structure and see if it's now adequate to the task that both AFRICOM and EUCOM place on it.
For now, AFRICOM is the small but able force of the U.S. military on the continent. As the partnership grows between AFRICOM and African nations, officials say the region will be better prepared to promote security, stability, and prosperity. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the African Union declared 2015 the year of women's empowerment in acknowledgement of the increasing role women are playing in Africa's development. We'll introduce you to women from the African diaspora who will share their personal stories on empowering themselves and their sisters on the continent for Africa's future. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing language influences. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello. I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. On Saturdays, tune in at 4:30 and 17:30 UTC, and on Sundays at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC. Or subscribe to the PCUSA podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA. That's Press Conference USA on VOA Africa.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Ay, punguza kidogo na mengine kadhalika toto si unanielewa hapo hapo liposhika ukiongeza kidogo uweza kutoa
is the remix, yeah. The remix, yeah.
So fly.
Akon, P-Square, Mr. Maybe, Convict Music. First of all, you're the type of woman that stays on my mind. Walk down the street, every guy wanna jump on your behind. It's your seduction to make sure that we stay in line. Sexual corruption, cause I'll kill anyone for your time.
Body na die you want baby. We supposed to live like family. Hey, I know the lie. There's nothing stopping me. She dey feel my swag and I get money. I dey try my best to be somebody. Cause I'm living life. She's girl they make me higher, higher.
I dey feel this baby. You no go believe.
This girl na die, die.
If you see this baby, tell him say she must chuck my money. Chop my money, chop my money, cause I don't care. Chop my money, chop my money, chop my money, cause I don't care. I don't care,
don't care.
I don't care,
don't care.
I don't care,
cause I get them plenty.
I don't care,
I don't care.
I don't care,
I don't care.
I don't care,
cause you know the empty.
My salt and stunts for you, you know I can. Farabale, kuma lole, omwele, I get pepe. Tempai, soro, kilo, shele. If you see her eyes, eyes, you don't go believe she's looking at me. Run down, baby, run down, baby. And when I'm done, done, tell me if you want some more, baby, some more.
I got $20 in my name, 20 naira in my name, $20 in my name, in my name, in my name, $20 in my name, 20 naira in my name, $20 in my name, in my name, in my name, $20 in my name, 20 naira.
I'm gonna get it done.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. This week, all those who are watching American television focus their attention on events in Baltimore. And naturally, those who are looking at U.S. policy towards Africa or any part of the world will pay attention to what some of the American scholars who have devoted a great deal of attention to U.S. policy towards other countries after the Cold War. Richard N. Hash, as I pointed out last week, in his book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, the case for putting America's house in order was raised in my analysis. Events in Baltimore draw our attention to the coordination of domestic policy and foreign policy. Without any doubt, most of the people who are looking at events around the world will come back to the United States as the most powerful country in the world and a country that is very much alert with regard to what is happening throughout the planet. When we had the crisis in Ukraine, many people were worried about Russia and the people of Ukraine. And people went back to the Cold War and remember how Nikita Khrushchev from Ukraine was the head of the Soviet Union. And of course, his story, his biography, is now gone, and the Soviet Union is now gone. Those became big issues, and those people who are looking at events in Ukraine went back historically to what was happening during the Cold War. The events in Baltimore suddenly will reverberate in African affairs because the Nigerians who came out of elections, many people were afraid of violence and many people were concerned about what happens before and after elections. The young people who were captured by Boko Haram brought a lot of attention to what was going on. So a news report coming out of Nigeria with regard to the activities of the military over there, capturing those people who were captured by the Boko Haram. Bring back to the whole question of domestic policy and foreign policy for all countries. Right now, the government in Nepal is very much caught up with the question of natural disaster. So that is one of the reasons why in the next couple of minutes, I'm going to look at how American policy towards Africa is very much related to events in Nepal, events in Ukraine, and even domestically for us in America, Baltimore. This is the whole question of natural disaster and foreign policy. This is very much related to human political decisions and foreign policy. If you look at natural disasters, you can see the role of the United States in Africa and elsewhere in the world. When we had crisis in Haiti, many people were concerned about what could be done for the people of Haiti. Suddenly, America was very much involved. America's policy towards the nations in the Caribbean and South America was very much involved. And of course, those who are looking at U.S. policy towards Africa will realize how any action on the part of America reverberates globally. The Senegalese and a number of other African countries, because they are Francophones and because they are blacks, were very much influenced by a decision taken by America with regard to the people from Haiti. And the Haitians were very much involved in the U.S. policy. America was very much involved. The Americans went to Haiti as part of their domestic policy because there were Haitians who migrated to the United States. And this is how Haitian national disaster went back to the migration of large number of Haitians or Cubans to the United States. And this is one of the reasons why U.S. policy towards Africa is very much linked to the problem of migration, poverty, economic development, and a number of other issues. Many people in Africa will be looking at events in Baltimore as echoes from America that reverberate in Africa. And many will draw parallel between what happened in Baltimore to what happened in South Africa. And again, here foreign policy is brought back to poverty and economic development all over the world. And when you have natural disaster, it always brings to light poverty and the human condition. Science and technology combine to make poverty more visible. We have internet, we have all these social media which can work together to really highlight the impact of poverty in a particular country, in a particular city, and in a particular village. And of course, poverty becomes more obvious when you have natural disaster. This was most evident in Haiti when you had a big earthquake in Haiti. And of course, events in Nepal brought to light the situation in Nepal, which most people were not aware of around the world. So that is one of the reasons why when you talk about U.S. policy towards Africa, or when you look at African opinions and attitude toward the United States, you come back to the problem of political engineering, social engineering, and cultural development in all parts of the world.
And thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Zainab Abdel Rahman, we say a big thanks for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, there is always a winner, even in a monkey's beauty contest. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A free and democratic society cannot exist without a free and independent press. Whether it be traditional print and broadcast media or newer formats, including blogs, websites, and other digital platforms, press freedom can keep the citizenry informed and can facilitate broad human communication. An unfettered press can expose corruption, report on the pros and cons of important issues, clarify laws and policies, and facilitate the exchange of ideas and public discussion. This is important because in a free society, the government derives its legitimacy from the electorate, and because informed voters are less easily led and more likely to hold their government to account when they cast their ballots. Clearly, protection of press freedom reinforces freedom of expression, which includes the right to seek, receive, and impart information, and allows individuals to make informed decisions. Despots the world over know this, and that is why they strive to keep a tight rein on the media and on the journalists who dig up information that may harm the censor's cause. May 3rd is World Press Freedom Day. This day of observance was established by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, to raise awareness of the importance of press freedom and to remind people around the globe that in dozens of countries, publications are censored, fined, suspended, and closed down, while journalists, editors, and publishers are harassed, attacked, detained, and even murdered. It is a day of support for media in danger of being censored or shut down, and a remembrance for those journalists who lost their lives while exercising their profession. And it is an admonition to governments everywhere that they have a responsibility to protect press freedom and freedom of expression, a universally recognized human right. Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States and one of the country's most influential founders, once wrote that were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. The basis of our governments being the opinion of the people, he wrote, the very first object should be to keep that right.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.